Given the current divisions of authority between DOD, NSA, and DHS, Department of Homeland Security, do you think we should create a new cabinet-level agency to be able to control and improve cyber defense?
No.
The answer.
That's the last thing we need.
As the non-government person here, no.
The answer is not more government.
Thank you.
It is. We actually have the wherewithal and the talent to be able to do this. It is too often the politics and the policy that stands in the way, which jeopardizes this country, in my view. That's what has to be solved. That is much more important than another agency. Part of the reason, and DHS has, the Department of Homeland Security, rightfully so, has the mission of protecting us internal to the country, including this threat. And obviously along with the FBI. There's not enough money in the world to create another agency like the NSA, which was responsible outside our borders. They have the engine, they have the technical expertise that has been developed over decades. We don't have the time or the money to create something new. We have to take, in my view, what we have and change it to meet the threat and the emerging threat. And all this, I'd like, you know, maybe Keith won't do this, but when Keith just sort of threw out, there are two terms up here. Keith threw out network speed. That's speed of light, if you're going to get at this. And in my simple mathematic head, there's 1,000 milliseconds in a second. We're talking about responding in 10 milliseconds or so, not minutes or day or hours or days or weeks to prevent the damage and the attack. We're a long way away from that. Everybody's a long way away from that right now. What are the standards? That's what government can do. They can drive us to solutions tied to that. But with what we have, not with more.
So just to add to that, we had a series of meetings, Mr. Secretary, because we had Secretary Napolitano, Secretary Gates, then you, Bob Mueller, and I meet on just this topic. The Defense Department's mission is to defend the country. DHS responsibility is Homeland Security, and FBI is the law enforcement. And all of those three have to work together in this space. Making another agency would only complicate it further. We actually had to look at, when we built Cyber Command, do we build it as a subunified, a unified, or a separate functional command, a separate service, and then others posited that. And we recommended going subunified to unified for all those reasons. And stopping before going to a separate service, because I thought it has to work with the service. And I think in this case, cyber has to work with the Defense Department defending the country. It's not a separate agency in that regard. Has to be able to work with law enforcement and DHS and passing information back and forth. But if Russia were to attack this country, cyber is one element of our defense, and there would be others. And I think it's putting all that together and ensuring the integrity of our systems, and that's kind of the speech of the Intrepid.
But Keith, I think, and Mike and Renee, I mean, the bottom line is we haven't done a very good job at coordinating policy with regards to cyber. And even though we've had special assistance and we've had, you know, individuals assigned to this, the fact is that somehow this has not come together in a comprehensive approach. What's the problem?
Actually, I'm not completely sure I would agree with you on that. Okay. At the time we created Cyber Command to basically have this capability, I was, and I remain, and Keith knows this, Keith wanted to reassure me that it wasn't going to be a problem, but You know, before this whole threat, the NSA had a mission. It was actually full-time, 24/7, 365 on taking care of the American people outside the borders. So now we lay on, you know, what I would argue is an equally substantial mission in the cyber world, and I was worried that NSA could continue to do both, if you will, even as we carved off this cyber command over time. And I actually think we've done a pretty good job of that, of creating it. Where we've struggled, and I think it's probably a natural struggle, is we've struggled with legislation. Both of you are heavily involved in that. That's not new when you're talking about, that's not a surprise when you're talking about something that's so new. We've been through a couple iterations of legislation, which is important. And I hope we can get there with legislation that actually makes a difference. That said, I think we're not as far along as I'd like to be at all. So from that standpoint, I think we've got a lot to do, and we need to recognize the speed with which we need to do it. And Washington right now is not famous for speed. And so I worry. I really do worry about that. And in that regard, I don't think we've done very well. But for what we've done in a relatively short period of time, given the threat, we've actually set up a pretty good system so far with lots more to do.
So we set this bubble chart out, which said that DOD's responsibility was to defend the country. As a consequence, DOD had to have some way of knowing when industry was being attacked. FBI had the law enforcement. They had the same. And so we created that, what we called the bubble chart, which laid out the lanes in the road, which said all the technical things that had to occur to ensure that each agency department could do its job. What I'm concerned as we go through the policy and the legislation is not all the people involved in those processes understand that. Yeah. And so what they confuse is that DHS's job to do this, and they say, no, DHS's job was to set the standards, to provide this, but it's FBI who actually does the internal law enforcement, and it's NSA or Cyber Command who does outside the country and would defend our nation.
Renee, this question talks about what are the biggest deficiencies in current legislation or rules or operational protocols, and what should this legislation look like? From the private sector's point of view, what is it that you need in terms of legislation to try to build this public-private partnership?
Well, I think I've mentioned this in a prior answer, that what we really have been seeking is some kind of liability coverage. And not so much the liability, but more of a framework where we can be more open about what we might be seeing without, you know, the effect of ongoing shareholder issues and other litigious people coming after us, you know, because they might think that something that is not really material is more material than it is, you know, because this stuff is complicated, right? So the fact that we see, you know, any company may see 50 set of tax, is that material? Not really, because none of them got through, but it's pretty useful to know that you're seeing the same repetitive attack coming from the same place, and if you can triangulate that with other people. So the sharing of the data in addition to the liability coverage and saying, you know, what kind of data is okay, I think would be helpful, because everybody seems to be unclear about what's allowed. Again, I am a fan of legislation when it enables something to happen. And so my biggest concern, Keith is right, we need different technology. So I want to reiterate that I agree with that. But we also, again, we need an operating protocol. Because as Keith has said, there are people who do this for their jobs every day, who know, like the FBI, like the NSA, who know what to do, but there's no protocol for someone in private industry knowing what to expect. You know, in the case that Keith talked about, Sony, there was a response, right? But that response was ad hoc because we had never completed this piece of work about if you should be attacked in this manner, who's going to do what should you expect? You know, and oh, by the way, Sony as a corporation don't worry about calling these people because you're going to be covered because this is considered a nation state sponsored attack. So you're not, your shareholders aren't going to come after you because you called these guys, right? So that's the kind of a framework, you know, something like that that we need. And, you know, the legislation, I know you all have been way more engaged in it than I, although we've been in the, you know, reviewing and that kind of thing, that we need. We need help.
Okay, this goes to the military guys. Instead of waiting for an attack by our enemies, wouldn't it be better to use our expertise to cyber attack our enemies while we have the most knowledge? Why wait for others to arm up like the Cold War?
I can't wait for me. So.
I think You obviously you can't go attack everybody out there. You know, it just doesn't look right. And but in practical reality, I think from our perspective, the real question is what are they up to, why are they up to it, and what do we know? So you have intelligence collection to ensure your force understands the status of the adversary, what they're doing, and where they're going, and that you have a reasonable expectation that you can see them coming at you. We can do parts of that today. We don't have the legislation, as Renee mentioned, that we need to go to the next step. But to unilaterally go in and do that, I think that puts us in the wrong light. Because as soon as we go in and say, take out their cyber arsenal, that's an act of war, in my opinion. And what we've done is just what we didn't want them to do to us, and now we're the bad guys. And I think in this case, while that may be a future strategy that people consider, I'm not sure it's one that we would ever take.
So in the construct of what do you do? And I'm certainly informed by my past for an existential threat that we've all grown up with in nuclear weapons. We created not just the capability, but the concept of mutually assured destruction. And I don't know that that isn't relevant here. And it is something that we, as a country, if we get the Russians and the Chinese to the table, and the Iranians for that matter, on these issues to create international rules that certainly both sides recognize that it's a two-way street, that's a place to start. Now, there certainly is more than just a small probability that they would cheat on that. I don't know, but I think if you get into a formal signed agreement, that you then have an opportunity to start addressing not just the capability, but also the cheating issues. I honestly don't know where else to go. When we're talking about this is a capability that can change our way of life, this can change their way of life. And so I agree with Keith. I think it would be seen as an act of war immediately, and all of the responsibility and issues that are associated with that. So it would have to be, it's not impossible, but it would have to be, I think, the only time I think I could see my way through that is if I sensed one was coming our way that threatened our way of life and that I would preempt. And we've said offense and defense. What's happening in this area is offense and defense and exploitation are all merging. We used to think about that as something you had time in between, and it was very clear differences. Not so. This is all very compressed space that you have to figure out what you're going to do in advance, so you do it in milliseconds. And that's in the military, much less what do I do with Intel and Sony or our financial system as it gets brought to parade rest. Those are the challenges, and that's what I think government and industry leaders have got to figure out to try to reconcile.
Well, let me just follow that. If our intelligence capabilities were good enough to figure out that we're going to be the focus of a cyber attack, let's say that we're concerned that there might be a cyber attack on our electric grid, and we're given that information, what do we do?
So I think here's the way I would have handled it. I would bring that to the secretary and the president. Those would be the two. We'd lay that out just like we do all the other threats and say, here's what we got. We'd go up through the chairman and all would be put on the table. Depends on how much time you have, is, I guess. If you say it's imminent, they're ready to press the button and we're going to stop that. That's where the rules of engagement would have to come in. Yeah. If you've got a few minutes, you'd call a video teleconference. If you've got a few days, you'd call the meetings and go up through the normal. So those hypothetical things, I think, are things our successors right now are working with. How do you set those rules of engagement up so that you have those ahead of time so that Admiral Mike Rogers and the team knows what they're supposed to do in this case? Like we've done with Northern Air Defense Command. We have to have those laid out and rehearsed.
You know, one other thought is, you know, does one head of state pick up the phone and talk to another head of state and say,
make my day.
We know this is coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah. Yeah.
We could get Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood, make my day. That's a caramel thing.
thank you, Keith.
Just wanted to point that out.
This probably goes to Renee. What is the one most important precaution that we as citizens can take to help improve cybersecurity, our cybersecurity?
I would say awareness of your own activities. How are you behaving online? Are you doing the basics? Do you, we call it good, you know, good network hygiene, good online hygiene, meaning do you have your firewall turned on? Are you using basic virus detection? Are you making sure that you use a product that scans so you don't go to sites that are known bad, that, you know, infect? Do you take reasonable precaution to secure your own information? Those kinds of things, you know, personal security hygiene is one thing that would be very helpful. The other piece of it that we have been advocating is the computing industry in general needs to raise the minimum bar on how these devices are made and what the minimum level of security is, because you can't expect end consumers to do all this themselves.
Mike, you might share with the audience what your wife said after going through the discussion
this
afternoon.
We're going to help her,
though. So I don't know how concerned you are about your personal identity. I can tell you my own story. I went through the Harvard Advanced Management Program in 1991 as a Navy captain, and I called it, you know, fun for 46-year-olds for 11 weeks in Boston. But we had some extraordinary professors, and one of them was a guy named Warren McFarlane, who was one of the leading IT guys, is still, but back then, 91 now I'm talking about. And he took us through this, we had him about an hour, 2 hours a week, and by week three or four, based on what he was telling me, or telling the class, I had given up my personal identity at that point, with where the technology was in 1991. Now, I live with a wonderful woman I have for almost 45 years, and I'd be nowhere without her. Deb still shreds everything with our name on it, everything with a number on it, as if we're still hiding our identity from someone. This is actually why, while we also, how many times have you said, I agree, I agree, I agree,
yeah,
I agree, I agree.
That's exactly right.
I agree.
That's right.
You know, to get up on Wi-Fi. So yep. Every time you agree, do you have a clue what you're agreeing to? No. You're just getting up on Wi-Fi. At a time where I actually believe it disappeared a long time ago, and I don't want to pay short shrift to this tension between your personal identity and national security, because it's a hugely important issue. And I'm not saying we should give up on it. That's just where I am, and I, you know, one family's view of the world that, you know, Deb still thinks, you know, we got to protect all this stuff. I think Google knows a whole lot more about me than the NSA will ever know about me, and I've worked there. So how do we and I thought it was interesting, the younger audience today that we had, students,
right,
was kind of an interesting. I said, so how many of you care about your personal information, or do you care? And a bunch of them said, no, I don't care. Then we said, okay, if you don't care, raise your hand. I mean, there was almost no hand. There was no public affirmation of the fact that they didn't care, even though young ones typically are a lot freer with their personal information than others. So this issue of how, it's right at the center of the Snowden debate, the personal ID, the freedoms, et cetera, in the political debate right now. What I hope we can do is we can create a law and a policy and a structure that protects us, gives up enough of who we are so that we never have a cyber, 9/11. Gordon England famously said, he was Secretary of the Navy at 9/11, he said they killed 3,000 on 9/11. They would have killed 30,000. They would have killed 300,000 if they could have. They're still out there. So what I would like to make, I'd like to try to facilitate and help on is, can we create the right policy, the right relationship with private industry to protect ourselves, similar to what we would create after a cyber 9/11, except not get there? And I don't know if that's possible.
Another issue to keep us awake at night. How vulnerable are nuclear power plants and other nuclear installations to a cyber attack?
I'm looking at Keith.
Keith, you want to?
I'm looking at you, Keith.
Venture a guess here.
Yeah. Well, I think all of them are vulnerable. I mean, if you take the statement that there are those who have been hacked and know it, and those who have been hacked and don't know it, but everybody's being hacked, I think the nuclear power, especially on the administrative side, has issues. On the operational side, I think they have taken huge steps in ensuring the integrity of those systems. That notwithstanding, the issue would probably be in the power and the electrical grids, not necessarily in the plant itself. So I think the plant has good safeguards. And I equivocate a little bit here because while we say it's good, anything's possible. And so what concerns me is an adversary, a world-class adversary going after it with the insight of what they could do to create a meltdown or something else.
Just one other quick comment on that. And I use that industry as an example, but part of what we are all challenged with right now is insider threats.
Yes.
Not just outside
threats.
That's right. Insider threats. Mm-hmm. Keith talked about 20 operatives, ISIS operatives, inside the country right now, but those who would do us harm from inside our system. And that, in my view, is going to cause, should cause, lots of leaders and lots of entities and institutions to put in place policies which don't allow what I would call single access, single person access to what could be a very fatal move inside a system like a nuclear power plant. You need two-person control in ways that we thought possibly we didn't in the past to protect against that, as well as, you know, behavior watching, I mean, all those kinds of things to make sure that we're okay inside, as well as worry about those who are trying to get us from the outside.
Let me ask all three of you. The technology we're talking about has just multiplied, developed, head over heel, and continues to do that. We're getting new stuff every year, new technologies. Look at the next, 4 or 5 years. Where is this technology going? What are we looking at? And is it likely to be even tougher to deal with the whole issue of cyber attack as a result of the new technologies that will develop? Renee? Yeah.
Well, it's not slowing down. We continue to deliver. I mean, the good news is we continue to deliver more compute power every couple of years than we ever have before, which is great because we make amazing breakthroughs in areas that we couldn't even think about, like specialized targeted cancer care and human genomics and all those kinds of things. The flip side of it is it gives a lot of capability to continue to evolve and escalate this
what has become a business in some ways of cyber. And I think, and I agree with Keith on this, that we're going to have to start to look at, and many of us are pioneering the edges of this, but maybe in some more collaborative way, new technologies for dealing with it. Because what's clear is that signature-based, which is what how antivirus and the industry has grown up, isn't going to be able to keep up. It isn't today. It's only going to get faster. And we see no end right now to some of this. And the encryption's getting more difficult and more complex, and you know, computing doesn't slow down. So one thing we can't hope for is to stop it. We need to find a different answer.
Keith, quickly.
So I'd just add to what Renee said. I think you're going to see a shift in cybersecurity. It's not clear if that will be after the cyber Pearl Harbor or if we'll be wise enough to do it ahead of that. That we'll have a new way of seeing your network, of protecting your network, of communicating within and among networks, industry to government. And I think 5 years from now that will be in place and that we'll have made those leaps. I think it's absolutely imperative that we do that with the Internet of Things, and so you're going to see that transformation.
Mike, you've got the last word on this. Where are we going?
The experts I've talked to in this is when asked how do we fix the Internet, it's start over if you're going to make it secure. And that's a daunting task. No one wants to hear that, but if you really want to make it secure, start over, which is scary, but in fact, I actually believe what they're saying.
Well,
look at the time.
The message is we'll start over and do it right. You know, this is obviously it's a fascinating issue because it really does involve our lives. It involves, you know, all of the technology that we're using these days, but I just want the public to be so aware of the fact that there is the potential here for the kind of cyber attack that we discussed that could virtually cripple this country. And I hope that through innovation and creativity and through leadership, we'll be able to prevent that from happening and to provide our children not only the greater use of this technology, but ensure that they have that better life that my parents cared about when they came to this country. So thank you all, and please thank our speakers.